All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Welcome to a worn out John Bowd and David Albee. We're worn out. We're in defiance mode at the moment, and those in unionized workforces in the UK will know exactly what we mean. And it is tiring, but stay with it. I would advise all trade unionists, stay with it. Stay with it. These people have got the nod from somewhere, somewhere high up. And if you can look up, keep looking. Because lightning don't strike twice. All big employers are behaving quite viciously, I would say. And putting kids in charge, which really bothers me. I'm not unless you're Jimmy Savile. John. We're talking about food rights, right?
We are. That's the main body of tonight's show. But yes, we are. And we're talking about all forms of defiance. We're so defiant, we're 8 minutes late because we don't even care about time anymore. We're not going to be... We are the young ones. We're not going to be constructed.
Up scumbag. Constrained.
Wait, up scumbag. Up
quick,
scumbag.
Elephant head's coming.
I was just saying to someone the other day, it's been a while since we made an elephant head reference. I was trying to think what else I could get away with that no one else would. Oh, that was it, because she was telling me to, you know, you'll have to somehow reference business time at some point. And I was like, I will, but I'm not going to tell anyone what it's from. They're going to have to work it out themselves. So it's Wednesday night. Oh, yeah, it's business time. Okay. So before we jump into the main body, though, it does. I think this is worth mentioning. It does seem like we're talking about Amazon a lot recently, but I'd just like to run this to you on the top of the show. Last week saw two more victories by workers at that company, again through uniting the workforce in a place where we were told they would never actually see it. Amazon showed up in Minnesota in USA around 8 years ago, and they brought with them their astronomical injury rates. It was then twice as high as any non-Amazon warehouses in the state, and this is down to management, basically. The enforcement of an excessively rapid pace of work using the electronic surveillance we discussed in last week's show, so you can spin back to that if you want to check it out later on. The Minnesota Senate has responded now by passing a very strong protection bill for warehouse workers that, among other things, requires Amazon to provide warehouse workers with written information about all quotas and performance standards they are subjected to, in addition to how those quotas and standards are determined. So again, if you remember last week's show, we were talking about how that stuff's never really been defined and it's somehow stored in a computer algorithm somewhere that nobody knows how to explain, and it's just one of them things. They're not having that in Minnesota anymore. Among other things, this means that Amazon cannot fire or take disciplinary action against a worker for failing to meet a quota that was not disclosed in the first place. This disarms one of their main weapons for keeping workers scared, but also as it is used against workers seeking better conditions. So it's very interesting then that the way so many companies, including one close to home for us too, is trying to emulate the gig worker, zero terms and conditions, not a life worth living type Amazon work, the Amazon model for working company, at the same time as their workforce are saying, no, we've had enough of that and we're fighting against it and getting some great victories. It should also be understood, by the way, this bill did not come from the lawmakers themselves. It was won by workers taking great risks to raise the alarm on safety issues at Amazon, and in particular, workers from East Africa who have been fighting there since 2007. While Amazon might have thought that hiring working-class migrants would reduce the risk of organizing, together with the AU Center, these workers did just that, and they won many victories along the way, like access to Somali-speaking management, time off for Eid, a prayer room on site, and ultimately the passage of the bill. This was not done by a group who distanced themselves from their wider community, however, as one racist media and political lead, our racist media and political leaders often accuse immigrants of doing, and especially African ones. But they did this by being directly involved and establishing what all workers needed to keep themselves safe from the increasing harms that Amazon's working conditions are thrown upon them. What Minnesota has shown is that by building popular power in workplaces and communities, the global movement to make Amazon pay can win progressive legislation that protects workers' health and livelihood. A similar story has played out here in Coventry, where Amazon workers, many of them also from East African countries like Somalia, have organised a majority of 700 workers into the GMB union and recently filed for union recognition. This comes after some recent high-profile strike actions last year and earlier this year. Word of warning to those workers, if you want GMB to actually do anything, you have to put a lot of pressure on them because they're one of those unions that really needs constant, you know, haranguing from their own members. As they await the outcome of their bid, they started another wave of strike actions this week, while their co-workers in Ridgely and Mansfield voted on joining them. In the words of Make Amazon Pay campaign, these victories show by coming together, we can build power in workplaces for better pay and conditions, win progressive change in parliaments, and make Amazon pay its workers, communities, and the planet. You can support these workers by joining up with Make Amazon Pay. You can find them online or the usual places. So some good news stories off the top. The clock is ticking, Mr. Bezos. Now, the main body of this week's show, whatever happened to food riots? Recently, Navarra Media published an article by Lewis Bassett that caught my eye and my brain regarding food riots. In the article, the writer discusses a famous case of what became known as a food riot in Sheffield on the morning of the 14th of April, 1812, when a group of unemployed men digging the foundations for a new cemetery downed their tools and marched to the marketplace where they joined hundreds of others who also happened to be out of work artisans. This crowd stole vegetables, fish, grain and butter because, as Bassett puts it in the article, they believed their prices to be unfairly inflated before proceeding to an arms depot where they looted and smashed the rifles stored there. End of quote. In the end, the uprising involved around 5,000 people. At the time, there was a war taking place in Europe that undermined Britain's ability to trade, and unemployment had increased along with the food prices. Food riots were once a regular occurrence across England from the early modern period until around the end of the Napoleonic Wars, although not all were what we would understand as a riot these days. They have been replaced these days, it seems, by an apathetic fatalism instead. In researching this, Lewis Bassett spoke with Steve Poole, who is a professor of history. Poole discusses how this was less of a riot, more what he calls a food disturbance, but they were certainly, in his words, a collective action designed to provoke magistrates into intervening. End of quote. These disturbances appeared, in Poole's words, when a shared set of values were contravened. Values that can be placed within what historian E.P. Thompson called the moral economy. Quick quote from there. The price of basic resources should never outstrip the ability of the poor to pay for them. This is an idea in which production and consumption are mediated by both law and custom rather than the market. End of quote. This was around the time of the 19th century when gradual political change was emerging for people in the lower class brackets of England, with Chartism and trade unionism developing what is also noted by the writer as what led to the welfare state. Cut to today. The writer vox popped outside a Tesco's in Rotherham last February, finding people are still angry about rising prices, but do not see any option for fighting back, merely getting on with getting poorer. He met people who have been out of work for some time, people buying the cheapest possible products, but no one seeing the possibility of anything getting better. In Bassett's words, in total, I talked to 26 people over the course of an afternoon, all were upset about high food prices, yet only four suggested anything could be done about them. The people Bassett interviewed were in favour of those workers who have been going on strike, but far too many he met spoke about the situation all being politically above them in some way and not wanting to get involved and feeling like they did not have some undefined qualification in order to get involved. As we discuss on this show often, we've seen a political project for decades to convince us that collective identity and action are impossible, when we know very well that they are anything but. While our times have seen the best resistance to all of this in years, we're still not over the hill yet. Our problems here can be most directly traced to Thatcherism and after that Blairism, where collective bargaining was attacked and the reduction in the state's ability, intentionally, to even be able to provide for their poorest citizens. Today we see the country's infrastructure crumbling as Britain has become a failed state. Whether intentionally or by the stupidity of our leaders and their greedy friends is debatable. The movements of people pledging to not pay their fuel bills are a good sign, but again built in an environment lacking the knowledge and direction of previous conflicts with a united working class, nor the distribution of such knowledge. We do know from leaked documents though, that the energy companies saw the don't pay campaign as an existential threat to their business model, according to Bassett. The poll tax riots took place over similar criteria too. People could not pay, politicians were not listening, and people had had enough. There is no reason we cannot apply the same criteria to food and energy. As economist James Meadway has warned, going forward, things will get even worse as climate change makes growing food even harder. In his words, these enormous and complicated reasons for rising food prices are difficult for people to unpick and, to an extent, obscure who is to blame. But, as with energy, giant agribusinesses have used their concentration of market shares to exploit these crises, making super profits for their shareholders. End of quote. We are all suffering from a system that praises the profit of shareholders and landlords, non-workers, it should be noted, over the health and well-being of the very citizens who created that wealth. We have even seen a dramatic rise in children starving in Britain, while all hope of a better future has been removed from our politics, in what seems like almost entirely. But never quite entirely. It cannot be acceptable that the holy position of shareholders now even outranks the right for people to be fed, even children. The number of billionaires in Britain has increased tenfold since 1990, and supermarkets made massive profits, not least during the pandemic, as the country's billionaires also grew. These are the targets of our understandable anger, and we should face them. We want controlled food prices, and only government can do that. And this week, Rishi Sunak's government kind of hinted that there was a possibility they would do it. I mean, I'm sure they'll screw it up five ways from Sunday, but nevertheless, it's a sign that they are being leaned on by the wider public. The biggest problem, however, is the lack of belief that we have a legitimate right to subsistence. We have allowed the moral economy to disappear and the idea of the modern market economy as natural and unchangeable to take hold instead. Something else quoted from Paul here. Where food rioters and magistrates once saw forestalling, market engineering and profiteering as interferences in people's right to bread, that's the sort of thing that in the 1980s we learned were entrepreneurial virtues. Now our supermarkets are full of items that we need, baby products, women's health products and basic foodstuffs that are security tagged when they never were before, because the price is written to such extremes that people are not stealing luxury items to sell as much as they are stealing basics to survive. The tannoys often spit out warnings to customers, like some abusive authoritarian overlord, about how we are all under surveillance while giving over our hard-earned money in increasing amounts to their supermarket chain, who are raking it in. And meanwhile, we normally have to power the tills ourselves and weigh our own products and all that other stuff. So we're now literally paying them for the joy of doing somebody else's job, which we don't even get paid for ourselves. This is all a bit of a broken arrow situation. When you have to security tag a block of cheese or a jar of instant coffee that has gone up to a tenner, the stealing part is not actually the point. This is because a systematic breakdown, a process over the last four decades to take power away from working people, but even more to convince us that we do not have any right to reject this state of affairs. They keep us chained with our material existence, getting poorer, getting harder to live and organize, while we live in constant fear of being in the street with no way to care for ourselves. All of this is well known. It is supposed to be, because it stands as a lesson that despite making, building and running everything, despite being the literal center of power, because nothing works without us, we are told that we should have no power. So this article is about how we used to not only be more united around our material lives, working, not getting what we are owed, having it stolen by the rich types who seem to exist beyond ever being holdable to account. But I bring it up specifically on the show because I find many things obscene in what is discussed here, but also because I refuse to believe that we cannot fight back. I just believe too many people are still unwilling to. This kind of disunity must be completely defeated. You cannot forget about any, you can forget about any general strike until we've overcome the overwhelming weight of four decades of having our power removed and our daily lives forced into chaos that keeps us busy with anxiety about how we can carry on. We even struggle to describe the horrors of daily life now. It feels so empty to describe how awful the world is, how much suffering goes unacknowledged or never finds any relief. Really, what do you say? No expression can change anything or even make us feel better anymore. Our problems are twofold here. a lack of a unifying big idea and the inability to believe one of these is possible. We have run scared of a big unifying idea for too long. And yes, some have tried and failed in recent times, like Corbyn did, because his big idea was so full of potential that they had to take it out at all costs. The same people want to make sure we have no power, no matter what. And how long before they take out our whole infrastructure and make sure that we do not gain control? That's, I do wonder. I mean, that's a question, really. You know, how long is it before they do that? They just basically chop the legs off of everything in this country just to make sure we don't get a piece of it. Your desire to not be involved in any of this is not an option. We must connect on issues where we undeniably have things in common, and we have more in common economically than politically or culturally right now. We know it is not right for anyone to be starving, but especially when there is so much money in this country, it is even more obscene. So that's the main thing I want to talk about this evening. I've got some other stuff, but yeah, I was really struck by that article. I was really struck by not just the comparisons. You know, I mean, it's kind of a bit stupid to compare something in 1812 to 2023, you might think. But actually, what's really striking to me is that the material needs that we were talking about there have not really changed at all. They're still exactly the same, and we're still fighting against a self-appointed elite who wish to take any potential power away from us to actually have any effect over those things that we need literally to survive. And this is a state of affairs which there is resistance to, and that's good to see, but that's becoming more difficult, as I'll underline in the next story that we cover tonight. Regards of protest, reaction and disobedience against this system. But just because it becomes harder doesn't mean it becomes impossible. You need to learn to tell the difference. So, you know, this is a call for unity, as ever, as everything is on this show. This is a call for unity and a call for fight back. It's getting scary out there, everybody. It's getting nasty.
I was going to ask, John, because you're quite...
Yeah, jump in.
So millennials are people that are born after 2000, right? I always get confused.
Yeah, something like that. So it's not quite, it doesn't work quite as simply as that. So it's like tail end of the 90s going into, or maybe tail end of the 80s, I think, going into the early 2000s.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
So
that, and then yeah. Gen X is?
Gen X is, so if the boomers were the 40s and 50s, then Gen X is late 70s. To early 90s,
right? And what about kids born in the sort of late 2000s?
There's a part of the back of my brain is telling me I've screwed up.
Gen X. Okay, so
the ones at the end of the 2000s going into that's the is that Gen Z or is that
Gen Z? That's it. Yep. You're right, Bowdy. Yep.
Fuck, I should know this.
Told you were clever. So it's a Gen Z, and even an element of Gen X, will never see defiance on a level that I saw or you saw or have experienced. It's really odd. So they'll never see a nationalized water or nationalized utilities. They grew up pretty much pay what we say and say nothing. And that's why we've seen a very, very, very slow but large decline in people actually getting up and actually voting. I think it's 13 million in this country. It's equally as it's bad in the US as well. But I was just reading about food shortage across the world, and a lot of the right-wing media apportioning it to Ukraine. One rag put poor harvests and poor farm workers. That means there's none, from what I gather. And of course, even the Guardian, shock horror, said that the government is just talking about nurses for nurses' pay, which is crap. They're not, rather than dealing with. So that's the figure at the moment in the UK is children. Children at the moment, it's roughly around the figure of 800,000 children are starving in this country. And if I said Somalia or Senegal or places like that, you'd probably think, yeah, that's standard. But I'm talking about the UK. and that's frightening. And also, I'm not a millennial. I forgot what I am, but I came up when there was used to queue for butter, 3 day week. There was no sugar. The media were saying it's down to strikes. No, it's not down to strikes. It's down to a large reliance on fossil fuel, and of course the monetary exchange in the 70s, which we saw in high inflation in the 70s. So don't give me that rubbish about trade unions bringing the country to a 3 day week. Yes, there was an element of that, but like today, you're seeing that now on inflation and the ability just to survive. The ability to survive and feed your family. 800,000 children on average starve in this country. At least in the 70s, they used to queue for that butter. there was no riots. Everyone just used to queue. And then the lights used to go out, and then you go, oh, I've got to do the ironing tomorrow, you know, that sort of thing. You'd be amazed how resilient people are. And, the lights have gone off. That's it, you know. We just put up with it. It wasn't, you know, there was no hate. So anyway, John, it's just ridiculous.
It's odd this, because I never really know how to respond to this. I don't have a clean answer to this one, I don't have one that's I don't have a clean answer to anything. But no, I mean, as in, I don't have one that's like simple. And I mean, I'm inclined to think we should never put up with anything, especially when our infrastructure is failing and those in power trying to blame somebody else, particularly the actual workers. So obviously there's that. But I mean, at the same time, we have a skewed sense of what is a need today, what is a real requirement. Fucking phone me when I'm on my show, man. Sorry, phone call. So, you know, I think that it's something that I remember having a conversation with someone, a boomer actually, who talked about growing up poor and saying, well, no, we didn't kind of have a lot of material things, but we had food, because food managed to be cheap enough, kept that way, in order to make sure that we were fed, and maybe other things weren't. Now, what we've seen now is not a realignment of priorities. That's not true at all. But what you've seen is, you know, decent food's got more expensive, and now all food, no matter, you know, decent or otherwise, is getting more expensive, and things like clothing have got graphically cheaper. Now, one of the reasons why these things got so much cheaper was, of course, the expanding, continual colonialist experiment in the world, which Britain took a part in as much as anywhere else, to make sure that we exported all of our manufacturing. So, you know, you took your factory, and this kind of thing that people like me were moaning about in the 90s and the early 2000s, you took your factory across the sea to a different land to manufacture your t-shirts, which when they came back over here only cost you £2. We knew very well that the mechanisms for doing this, the employment of child labor, the working people for 18 hours a day, forced overtime, terrible conditions, kind of thing that resulted in the Rana Plaza collapse factory about 10 years ago now. And again, this is the reason why I shout out, you know, previous interview guests, Jay from No Sweat, because of the great work they do to kind of provide No Sweatshop clothing, and very comfortable they are. I'm wearing one of their t-shirts right now, actually. You know, this was the new way of the kind of in American politics, they kind of talk, or American history, they kind of talk about it as pushing out the frontier until the point where you get to, you know, basically sticking your power into every part of the world, to say where that is. And Britain's done something similar. The problem is you reach a point where you can't go any further, you turn around and the frontier comes home. So the realm of kids stitching together your £2 t-shirts and not ever enough to eat or enough shelter, that's come home. Barnardo's and the British Red Cross a few years ago literally came home to start working in communities here in Britain, because this is where they were finding all of the deprivation and the starving and suffering and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, this is part of the great collapse of empire. That's true. There's an element of that. But I think it's also just that people just have allowed themselves, and we've all done it to a degree, perhaps have allowed themselves to assume that this, it couldn't happen, or when it has happened, it's taken everyone by shock. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I thought I'd talked you into a coma. Good. It's good.
I mean, as I said, John, it's a shame. Maybe it will make a comeback. We're seeing a lot more online activity on Twitter, a lot more sharing of injustices. And I saw that pretty much over the pandemic. I saw some kids using 21st century methods of sharing injustice. George Floyd, I mean, we would never have known that if it wasn't for social
media. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that created a global movement, even though they tried to paint it as like thugs, some sort of thugs, you know.
But they always do that, though, don't they?
Yeah, just some sort of, look at them, they're just thugs, you know. Yeah. I mean, they
portray the propensity us. For the propensity for American media and British media to paint anyone black as a thug is really quite...
Well, I found the British media totally sympathetic towards the cause. We had Sky... Yeah. Black Lives Matter, they still got a channel called Black Lives Matter. There's all sorts of media, online media, and on the big platforms, even the BBC Black Lives Matter, BBC iPlayer got a section of Black Lives Matter, you know, and they were totally sympathetic, because when it happens in America, you know, it's a fold your arms, it's what's going on there, you know.
Oh, yeah. That was so true. So just to say on that was so true, because there was all these things of people, you know, sort of the kind of people who work for Murdoch papers, sort of on Twitter going, oh, isn't it terrible the way the police are treating people in the streets in America over just trying to express their beliefs. And then you go back through their timeline and find they were the same people who were calling for the army on the streets of Britain in 2011 when there were uprisings then, you know. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and they're extremely quiet during that whole Lineker thing.
Oh yeah, weren't they just? Yeah.
You know, that you know, it wasn't a fold your arms moment. And he shouldn't be doing that. He just talks about football. You mean the place where actually racism is still hugely existent. You know, and then there's a big outcry when England go and play in Albania and they make monkey noises, you know. You didn't want to go to Chelsea, you know, on a Saturday. You want to check that out, that'd blow your fucking mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, this is hypocritical, John, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it's the it's important for us to discuss this, but it's, in some ways, my contempt for the pettiness of the people involved is almost puts it beyond any kind of meaningful discussion. But you know, there's just this, again, that's still kind of the attitude of thinking that we're better than this and the other, but we're not better than anything. And that's why, as I said, we live in, I don't take joy in describing this country as a failed state. I honestly believe that. If anyone, you know,
listen, even the left won't admit that at the moment Campbell was right. He is right, what he's saying. He is right challenging the media. He is right going on BBC saying, why do you keep bringing these people on here and making them lie? And all they can say to him was, oh, aren't you the man that did the Iraqi thing? It's like, okay, you've lost the argument. The BBC has a propensity to bring on these people, whatever it is, Brexit or whatever. And he challenged the BBC live on, and he challenged the wrong person. I think Victoria Derbyshire's all right, actually, especially doing the Grenfell thing. I think she did a wonderful broadcast. And he challenged the BBC, and he did regret about Victoria, but he challenged the BBC live on air and said, why do you keep bringing these people on and allowing them to lie? A lie to the general public, a lie to the licence fee payers. Mm. And, you know, and even the left had to say, well, you know, maybe he was a bit rude to her. But come on, he called them out for what they were. And that whole Brexit thing, you know, he's called it out for years. And who are the funds these people? Who funds this? You get Farage and people like that. Who funds these people? They don't come on telly and travel the country on pocket money.
Well, you've talked about this for years. I mean, about, you know, hard right groups being so far. We've talked about in our first show, actually, when we mentioned Jim Dowson, people like that. But I mean, the Yeah, I mean, look, for whatever it's worth, okay, you brought it up, so I'll just put my line under this. I understand some of the reaction towards Campbell's attitude and manner, and he is dismissive, and that's because he's a complete arsehole, and he always was. He is a man who should be in prison for what he did in regards to Iraq. But at the same time, on this particular issue, he was right. You keep bringing one of the things Brexit has in this country. One of the things I've seen for years. I honestly can't even remember where I first saw it or how long it went on for. But it's the kind of people who want to push these really appalling agendas, these anti-worker, you know, racist, whatever else they normally tick every box, agenda for something, be it Brexit or whatever else. And when it doesn't work, their attitude is always the same, which is, well, we haven't done it hard enough, or you need to do more of it, or you need to do it this way. And it's like, no. You've had the hardest possible Brexit. The thing you wanted has been carried out. It has gone the way it was planned. It has been done for the reasons it was planned to do, which is to try and shut down even more of our workers' rights, even more of our right to actually live decently as citizens. I'm not any kind of a hardcore Remainer. I don't like those snobby little elitist tosspots. They are the same kind of people I was talking about a minute ago. I understand all of that. I'm just looking at the basic facts of what goes on there. And when the people who were pushing that agenda were as wholly irredeemable as Johnson, Farage, Rees-Mogg, etc., knowing perfectly well what it is they really wanted to do with this, then it speaks for itself. It's kind of like, I mean, I remember when it happened, I was thinking, should we do a show talking about Brexit? I couldn't be bothered in the end because it's happened now and we need to move on and try and get, you know, try and get things back and try and preserve and build, not just preserve, but build our workers' rights and our rights as citizens in this country as it slowly becomes an authoritarian hellhole. My position on it is this is what big business wants. What big business wants is never going to be something that you or me want, because we're the ones who are always subjected to their extremism and their brutality and their whims. Like I say, it's weird, isn't it? The companies we know of, a company we work for is trying to emulate the worst aspects of Amazon, and yet Amazon are losing that fight as we speak anyway. So you really just, I sometimes wonder if, like, is there a possible accidental chance that some of these folks are playing, you know, seven-dimensional chess, or are they actually just as stupid as I think they are? And when I find out that they are as stupid as I think they are, it doesn't actually fill me with, you know, chest puffed, smug glee. It actually just makes me really, really afraid. They are that dumb, which is why I say I wonder if they'll actually burn the entirety of the country's infrastructure down just to make sure we don't get a piece of it.
Don't quote me on that, John, but you never know what might happen. Even I've spoke to the most vehement neoliberalists online and people that I know, and Tony Blair. What we absolutely agree on is right wing manoeuvres.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because it's you can see it. I mean, good political analysts can see it. Even the neoliberalist political analysts can see it. And the thing is, where we had in the 70s and 80s, when I grew up, it was institutionalizing the police force. And good politicians stood it down, or pretended to stand it down. At least in the 80s, it changed. It just changed to, you know, we're going to smash your head in if you strike, and you're all thugs. But even the most ardent neoliberalists totally agree with the majority of people that I know that we have is right wing manoeuvres. What's going on here? It's blatantly right wing. It's racist. It's actually anti women. It's anti everything. You know, and that's where they fall short. And look, some of them don't come out on TV. We have to wait till question time or some stupid thing like that. Look, I don't agree with Campbell on a lot of things, but I was really pleased that he called out the BBC and media and on Twitter and said racism for what it is. coming from the very highest level, and the media feeding that frenzy, and talking about Gary Lineker and the BBC, which he called authoritarian right wing, to their faces. John?
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, you know, I still want to see him in prison, but I'll take that into account when we lock him up. That's fair enough. should we jump into the next story then? Okay, Free the Brookhouse 3. Griff Ferris has written for Navarra Media, again, a very good site this week for providing info for this show. Thank you very much, Navarra. Griff Ferris has written for them about his trial that, along with two others, began this week. Not only do we wish them the best and demand their freedom for their brave acts, but it is worth looking at this case for more examples of how this country is becoming ridiculously authoritarian and extreme. The Brookhouse Three are called so because they locked on as part of their protest to prevent 50 people being deported from Brookhouse Detention Centre to Jamaica on the 22nd of November 2021. The deportation would have removed the victims to a country some of them had not lived in since they were children or even babies. They did this, in Ferris's words, as an act of physical resistance against the violence and injustice of deportations, to prevent 50 people from being torn from their families and children and from facing other more serious consequences, end of quote. Many previous deportees have actually been killed when they've got there. In the end, only 4 people boarded the flight, but the persecution of protesters are facing is now out of proportion. As Ferris writes, quote, did we recently plunge 500,000 children into poverty? No. Are we responsible for the deaths of more than 130,000 people under austerity? No. We attempted to stop a deportation flight to Jamaica, and this is the response of the state. End of quote. The inhumane conditions in this country's immigration detention system are well known. Many people in immigration detention have restricted or no access to legal advice, meaning their last-minute legal challenges are common, and this is one of the reasons to block these flights, because it helps to buy more time. 13 challenges were made in the 24 hours before this particular flight left. Some of these 50 were related to members of the Windrush generation, and the scandal surrounding their treatment a few years ago, which has still not seen any justice, is, again, in Ferris's words, a stark reminder of how this country continues to treat minoritized ethnic communities, some of which the British state actively encouraged to come here as subjects of empire. End of quote. People who basically can still be abused with impunity, sometimes to the detriment of their health and even their life. My way of putting it. The protesters felt an obligation to resist in a country that seeks to further entrench a vicious border regime, is making transphobia more mainstream and far worse, divide the rich and the poor even more, and to further racism. All of this in the climate of protest being further attacked with heavy laws and sentencing to prevent us from taking this necessary action. The Brookhouse Three were charged with aggravated trespass, which carries a maximum sentence of about 3 months. Fair enough, we might think, because, I mean, they did trespass, I suppose. But months later, the Crown Prosecution Service, the CPS, decided to add another charge, a much more serious and archaic offence of causing a public nuisance, which can carry a much stiffer sentence. This comes weeks after 2 Just Stop Oil protesters were jailed for around 3 years for climbing a bridge and hanging a banner from it. Well, last year, we also saw Kill the Bill protesters in Bristol imprisoned en masse, one for over 15 years for demonstrating against these new police powers. The CPS is supposed to be neutral, but it rabidly pursues protesters these days. Since 2020, we've seen a large growth in police powers, including their ability to shut down protests pretty much on a whim. If it gets too loud or too disruptive, and the broad definition of, again, causing a public nuisance are all methods that they can use to shut down protest. And sentences ranging from a fine to a year in prison. All this is just a fraction of what the government wanted to introduce, but several other protest-related offences were thrown out by the House of Lords. So we are relying on protection of our democratic rights by an unelected upper house that we should have got rid of years ago. And with this in mind, we may just see that coming from a conservative direction in the near future. It wouldn't surprise me. In fact, some of these new offences have returned with the Public Order Act, making locking on a criminal offence. Remember those luggage straps during the coronation? Suspicionless stop and search powers for police in relation to protest and protest offences and protest banning orders, which allow judges to ban particular people from going to protests or even being involved in them. Aside from prison time, criminal records can prevent people from finding housing, getting jobs and undertaking education. So this is a major impact on people's lives for daring to stand up to an unjust power. They are basically shutting down dissent. This is not a free country. The Labour Party have said that they will not repeal the Public Order Act, as former head of public prosecutions himself, Keir Starmer, is rather fond of this authoritarianism. In Farage's words again, threatening peaceful protesters with life in prison is authoritarianism, full stop. But that doesn't mean we should accept it. Those of us who can resist must, not forgetting that protest is an act, not a gift from those in power. End of quote. Government, and especially this one, know how effective protest can be, and this is why they are doing this. It has prevented deportation flights, stopped immigration raids, and is pulling apart the horrors of the immigration industrial complex, in the writer's words, and we have to take these risks. So to sum up, never trust the police, always fight against these kinds of laws, and victory to the Brookhouse 3. I hope they are released sometime very soon. So yeah, more shutting down of our democracy, our democratic rights. I think one of the biggest problems with protest is it's one of those things that too many people have just never had the guts to get involved in, or because they're very comfortable in their lives, thank you very much, they've perhaps never seen a need to. But it's truly shocking that anyone would advocate for these kind of attempts to remove it, these attempts to shut down people's liberty. It's all, as I say, it's all a little bit beyond words, actually. So I feel like maybe rather than talk about it too much, you should just get on with resisting it the best and all available opportunities. I don't know. So where are you on this, Dave? What do you mean?
Well, you know, I'm used to an apathetic, the amount of times I represent members, and you know, and they say, when did that come in? When did that come in? I was all right for 20 years, 30 years. When did that come in? Who done that? You know, did the union agree that? No, that's the law. The law. I never heard of that before. A friend of mine, you know, and I said, well, when was that? He said, yeah, it was about 70-something. I said, okay. Things have changed a lot since. There's a gradual decline, a gradual taking away bits, little bits. Every time a certain government comes in, it says they put it back, but then the majority of time it gets taken away. And it's interesting, John, when we talk about the law and when we put some, a motion goes into the House of Commons. So it goes into the House of Commons, it gets debated, it goes to the House of Lords, it gets agreed, comes back again, gets rewritten, has to be agreed to rewritten, then it goes back again, then it goes back again, rewritten, then it goes back again. This is one law, this is how it works. But I'll tell you something, if it comes to workers' rights or basic people having a quality of life, it shortcuts straight in, mate. And what they do every general election, and I'm not saying which government, I'll leave that to your imagination. They've got it all set up. They hit the ground running. And it's terrible. And we just sit there with our arms folded and watch this shit show. And, you know, I've got to look at other countries like Francisco comes on and talks about South America. And I just think, well, for some reason, the world thinks that these are all savages and all. Who's the drug dealer, John? What's his name again?
Well, Pablo Escobar.
Yeah, they all think it's all Pablo Escobar and Al Pacino, Scarface. Well, actually, you know, free hospital healthcare and quality of life, you know, and people's governments getting voted in and fighting their way in to the last thread of their being to get in power, to get the normal working people's lives of standard. I wonder who is the Savages, John?
I couldn't have put it better myself. I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, you have to demonise people in other parts of the world, lest we get good ideas from them. And South America, or Latin America, sorry, I should say, the entire region is a really great hotbed of radicalism at the moment, which has been under extreme threat, you know, lest we forget the coups.
Let's forget that Venezuela's got more oil than Saudi Arabia and most of the Middle East. But what they'll do in Venezuela, they will protect that. I know in my country, they're having a dispute with Guyana over certain... Because like Denmark, Norway, rather than sell it off, they'll keep it for themselves and generate for their own country, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, this is the thing, you know, Thatcherites don't like, there's a lot of things they don't like, but they, you know, democracy and human decency.
There's nothing
decency.
Great, I'm sorry to say, there's nothing great about this country, just like Google destroyed America.
Yeah,
as Chuck but
they
said.
But they don't like it. Thatcherites don't like it when you remind them what an economic failure it was under her watch to not nationalise that money that we found with North Sea oil and to actually just give it over to already rich friends. And it's one that's one in particular that bugs them, I think, because they just kind of don't like being.
Well, it's funny when people commentate on the French and say, well, they get subsidised gas and we're paying for it.
Well,
that's not because they're French.
Maybe we're not that clever.
Maybe we're not that smart, you know. We've never been smart. Admit it.
Maybe you have to do something... maybe you have to do something that involves, I don't know, just not sitting on the sofa and tutting. I mean, I don't want to... I don't like getting these kind of conversations. You know, this is a weird one. We need to talk about this sometimes. But there is a strand on the left that feels like, you know, if I say things like this, if I talk about the kind of hogs that I grew up with, that there's something kind of inherently anti-working class about it. And actually, I've got to say, the first mistake you're making there is assuming the people I'm talking about are working class. In my experience, I tend to be more towards the middle, who I'm openly happy to detest. But, you know, we do kind of have to talk about, we need the kind of spaces to be able to discuss the worst aspects of us and our own cultures that let us all down. Because, you know, what do we want? We want those things to stop. I mean, is it inaccurate? Is it incorrect or improper to say, I wish to see an end to ignorance around me? And that's not accusing someone of this, that, and the other, but, you know, we all know it. We know people. We've met people. We have family members sometimes who are genuinely very ignorant about things, and we would like them to be better educated. That's not a judgment upon them, like, with my nose in the air. It's quite the reverse. Why do I want them to be better educated? So they can learn to punch up rather than down, for one thing.
Well, I'm going
to
get people annoyed now if you're waving your flag somewhere.
Yeah, go on.
When we look at parts of the world, in India, for example, and Modi, and I'm not a fan of Modi at all, but he is gathering a group of people called Global South, I think it is. So basically, these are all the Indian colonies, Papua New Guinea, all the way, you know, and he's calling it the Global South movement, where he says, these are all the countries, we're all going to get together and we're going to be better than anyone else in regards to technology. And they are all building, they're all getting together and they're building things like the internet and platforms, digital platforms, all this stuff. And the Global South is based on all the countries that were traditionally Western influenced, including colonization. And he's creating a movement there and it's overtaking the UK, big stuff. And he's creating all these countries, Fiji, Malaysia, Indonesia, as I said, Papua New Guinea. And they're coming over and it's like the G7, but they're all like, we were colonized once, we had too much influence by the West, they took everything out of us, and we're going to come back better. And I've got to be honest, they're overtaking most of Western Europe. And in 20 years, maybe we... As I said, John, maybe we're not so smart as we think we are and everyone else is savages.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're obviously talking about...
John.
I know. We're obviously talking about a particular strain of... But you and I are familiar with growing up, no doubt. But actually, I mean, yeah, you know, you need to admit where somebody does something better than you, and that's kind of part of internationalism, I suppose. But it's also just... It's not... You know, explain, especially now, I say this to people now, especially now, explain to me the benefits of your patriotism, because you've got less and less to cling on to, no, literally. If you use some form of patriotism as a basis for growing things and making things better in your mind, well, all right. I mean, that's not where I get my motivation from, but okay, go ahead. Same attitude I have towards religion or spirituality, two things that I, in my personal life, could care less about and have no connection to whatsoever. But if it's what motivates people and keeps them going down, you know, bad roads, or keeps them going towards, you know, pits of anxiety and depression, then good for you. Cling on to that and may it be your guiding light. You know, that's fine with me. Don't try and force it on me or anyone else, but that's fine. But it's exactly like, I mean, what do you want to feel, you know, I think pride is a waste of time anyway with certain, most of those kind of things. But what do you want to feel proud about right now? As I said, having all of our rights eroded to protest against an indecent power like we were talking about tonight. Do you want the inability for people to be able to afford to feed themselves, to be able to feed their children? Is this something you're proud of? When are you going to stand up and do something? Anyway,
I'll never forget sitting in a restaurant. I've told you, I've said this story, but this is 2019 or whatever. I'm sitting in a restaurant with my two friends, Pac-Man, and was one of them. And we're ethnic minority in an Indian restaurant. We regularly go there. They show the cricket and we have a laugh. And we were in a state in the UK where it was uncomfortable. And this gentleman, I won't say what nationality it was, but he just thought he'd approach us three and said to me, in the 2019 this was, and said, I'm not blaming you lot, but Brexit is down to the Sri Lankans.
Ah.
Obviously...
Didn't we know Sri Lanka was in Europe?
I think he said Harrow. Brexit in Harrow is because of the Sri Lankans, or something like that.
Actually, a creepy, narrow, crap at geography, is that
I just, you know, he just thought he'd come, you know, and tell us a narrative of... He's the author of everything. And we took a 70, well, I did, for a millisecond, took a 70 sort of, don't say anything. Two things went through my mind. One, I need John Bowd here. And two, I just came out with, and I said, I hope England lose the World Cup, and I hope we beat you at cricket. And it was like... Don't say anything, don't cause trouble. And he just walked off because I wasn't having it. This is 2019. Who are you talking to? You just thought you'd get up and approach us in an Indian restaurant. And I just, you know, and I just thought, John, you know, this thing that we're clever, we're not that clever. We're not. There's other countries that are smarter than us.
We've come around quite nicely then, because we started with me talking about, you know, Somalians are another group of people who get a lot of this caricatured hate of being, you know, lazy and criminal and feckless and whatever else. And, you know, where did we start this evening? Two examples of people from that part of the world. One group, you know, emigrating to this country, one group emigrating to America, who are now basically holding Amazon, the biggest, you know, the most powerful company in the world, probably, to account, and forcing them to hand over the workers' rights that they have so bitterly attempted to prevent from happening. Their fight is only just beginning. Don't get me wrong, and there will be setbacks. But, I mean, this idea of these folks, you know, shutting themselves away in their own communities. One of the things that used to bug me growing up was like, you know, these people over here, you know, they don't mix with the rest of the community. And I'd be like, okay, A, who do you mix with who doesn't look exactly like you? And B, I don't mix with you because you're a cock. So it's, and I look the same as you. So are you not actually...
I think I was talking to Pac-Man yesterday. We went out and we were talking about the Asians that came over in the early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Which was very brave. You know, they left their comfort zone and started communities where they'd meet each other, people they grew up with, and like-minded people who came over. They'd bring clothes for each other's kids. They'd share spices which you couldn't buy then. And they created a community. We admittedly said that community's, you know, through age it's died, and I think with Gen X and that, people are just doing different things. But what an amazing time. I think the BBC, Patman sent me a link, because it showed they got a family from an Asian family and got them to live like an Asian family in the 70s. And then people work, man, just to buy a house, you know, and saved. Yeah. And that's smart, don't you think, John? That is smart. To bring up 6-7 kids as well, and Jesus.
Did you, I mean, they had the, I don't know, there was more of an ability to do that too. That's what's being put out. The disconnection between, this is something we've talked about before, we should probably wrap up on this. I don't want to eat up too much of your show. But the disconnection here is that, you know, I said this before, that I don't buy into the whole kind of, you know, hard work will bring you reward. We know that's bullshit, especially in a system that's as rigged as this one. You don't need me to tell you that, okay? I'm not even going to condescend people by telling them that. But at least, you know, you had people saying, well, if you do, sorry, I should be more specific. You had political leaders saying, well, we believe if you do this, that, and the other, things will get better, and your poverty is temporary, you know, you'll work your way out of it. Now, they don't even bother with that. The argument is, well, you shouldn't be buying Heinz baked beans. You should be buying the cheaper ones. Well, the cheaper ones have got expensive as well. Well, then just don't buy beans. You know, don't eat cheese sandwiches. It's too expensive. I mean, a response like that from a leader used to get their head cut off in certain parts of the world, not to that far from here. You know, it is shocking to me in a way, because I just never realized it would be that naked. It's like Rees-Mogg the other week sort of saying, well, we probably shouldn't gerrymander votes because we've done that already and it hasn't worked out that well for us. I mean, just imagine, I know that man is just a literal streak of piss and arrogance, right? But just imagine the confidence that he can have in being able to say that, because who's actually going to pull him up on it? A handful of decent media outlets and you know, a few people down the local hipster club, you know, but they're whatever one of those looks like. But you know, but this is what I mean. It's like, yeah, this is why they're shutting down all these abilities to protest. They're shutting down because then there's like, we will do what we want and you will have no response to it. We're going to take everything. We're going to share it only between us and our friends who already have everything anyway. Our greed is going to be completely unlimited and we don't care if your fucking children starve. You know, it is, how badly can you be treated before you do something? Anyway, a lot of people are, you know, not putting up with this, and we're fighting back, and our great union battles continue. And we've already, you and I have already taken part in a battle that's cut the head off of a CEO, and we're just waiting for the little, you know, psychotic dipshit behind him to go. So, and it will happen. So on goes the fight. Unless you've got anything else to sum up with, Dave, I'm just going to say, should I just remind the folks
that
we're not
going to
be live next week, are we?
Yeah, so I'll be actually on holiday. So myself and John, when we have annual leave as trade unionists, we don't, unless we leave the country or one of us dies, and it's sad, I don't mean to be dramatic, but it's true, we will pick the phone up. So we don't actually get annual leave, but I am actually leaving the country, so, because that's the only way to do it.
You are coming back, though, yeah?
Maybe not. Maybe I'll become an oil baron or something with JR and Bobby Ewing. Nobby Bobby.
walk out of the shower 3 months later. his skin must have been well wrinkly. So it'll be. So we'll put on a repeat for you next week. I'm sure it will be eerily prescient. As these shows always tend to be. For God's sake, can someone just make my shows, you know, out of date and irrelevant, please?
Exactly. I was going to say, John, I could book something up from 2016.
Yeah.
Which, to be honest, I mean, the shows from 2016, 17, 18, 19, we were seeing exciting politics, revolutionary stuff coming through. Mm. We were seeing things that bucked the trend, and boy, were the establishment scared. Jesus.
Well, that's why they're reacting as they are now. I mean, let's be honest. That's why we're under this kind of attack. And as I said, the very idea of us having access to the infrastructure, honestly, I think they'd rather burn it to the ground. It's frightening. Frightening to think about. Well, we have to stop them. Simple as that.
Absolutely. John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll catch you the week after next.
You will.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.